and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP content, and specifically we're continuing on to assess and mitigate our vulnerabilities. And we got some good stuff coming up here, Adam. I know we got some terminology we've got to go over and a few other things, so let's just get right into it. Here's Mr. Adam Gordon.
Vocabulary Master Gordon to you, sir. All right, so we're back. Let's talk a little bit more about assessing and mitigating vulnerabilities. We've been having a very good discussion so far in our other episodes about all the things we have to do to think about how we're going to actually take care of these issues and concerns. What we're going to do now is drill down a little bit on some vocabulary specifically related to encryption and cryptography that's going to help us to better understand the whole thought process behind this approach. There's a lot of things that go on when we think about encryption and cryptography, a lot of working parts, a lot of language. And, you know, information security is as much about the language we speak as about the things we do. And when it comes to preparing for and ultimately being successful to take and pass an exam like the CISSP, vocabulary is crucial. So we're going to make sure we spend some time going over definitions. Speaking of which, we probably want to make sure we can see the definitions as opposed to just talking about them. Look at that. It's magic, I tell you. It's magic. So let's begin our conversation around the vocabulary with regards to encryption, with regards to cryptography solutions. Let's talk about key clustering. First one up on the list. You'll see key clustering talks about different encryption keys ultimately generating the same ciphertext from different plain text. So what we're talking about there is the idea of a key. An encryption key is effectively going to be the magic ingredient when we talk about using cryptography. It's the thing that allows us to effectively encrypt or decrypt on demand. And we'll talk in a couple of minutes about the different kinds of keys and what they are, but different encryption keys ultimately generate the same ciphertext. Ciphertext is just simply the encrypted text. If we take an example of the sentence, the dog is blue, we run it through the encryption engine, out the back end comes ciphertext. What we put in on the front end, plain text, is the message, the dog is blue. So different keys generating the same ciphertext from the same plain text is a problem because now we have a pattern. And if we can latch onto a pattern with anything having to do with encryption or cryptography, we're going to find a way, potentially, not a guarantee, but potentially find a way to exercise some sort of an advantage and maybe break the crypto system. So key clustering is bad because it allows the attacker to find patterns that could potentially lead to the exposure of one or more keys. Synchronous versus asynchronous encryption and/or decryption requests. Let's just talk about how things are done. Synchronous processes are done immediately. When you do something or doing multiple things synchronously, you're doing them immediately. When something is asynchronous, you're queuing them up and doing them in some sort of organized fashion, but they're not going to happen immediately. So you may submit a request, but it may be queued up and it may take a minute or two until it processes. That's what an asynchronous solution is. A synchronous solution is happening in real time. As you submit it, it's being done. So we often talk about digital certificates and PKI when we automate the process of using a certificate authority and we are submitting requests to the CA over the web through a web server interface as being synchronous because the system will automatically generate the certificate and validate the request in line in real time. And if you are then a legitimate user, we'll issue your certificate immediately. When we are doing it manually, we talk about it being asynchronous because there's a delay and we queue it up and we have to wait for it to be processed. So I want to make sure we just understand the difference between the two there. If we could just scroll down just a little bit, there we go. Hash functions, a hash function is going to be the way in which we can establish integrity, and we can also potentially establish that information has either been modified or not, with or without our knowledge. So the formal definition, a one-way mathematical operation reducing a message or data file into a smaller fixed-length output of what we call a hash value. What we really talk about with hashing is the ability to use variable amounts of data, so any size data input, plus a hashing algorithm equals a bit stream, a fixed bit stream out the back end. Now that's a formula, quote unquote. It's not a formal formula, but it's kind of an informal way of thinking about what a hashing function actually does. So let's just walk through a quick example here. Again, let's use the sentence, the dog is blue, because it's an easy one to remember and it's easy to work with, right? The dog is blue. Four words, not very, very complicated, probably a total of about 30 or so characters, right? So if we're gonna take the dog is blue, run it through a hashing algorithm, either MD5 or SHA-1 or something of that nature, what we're going to do is take variable size input, the dog is blue, run it through the hashing algorithm, and out the back end, depending on the algorithm we choose, comes a fixed bitstream representation of the data. Not the data itself, and not cryptographically protecting the data so that we are providing confidentiality, but rather cryptographically hashing the data so we provide integrity. That's what hashing is all about. And so we don't spit out the back end ciphertext when we hash, but rather a randomized, we'll put that in air quotes. Everybody do air quotes with me. They're so much fun. Air quotes, right? So we are going to spit out a randomized bitstream value. In the case of MD5, it would be 128 bits. In the case of SHA-1, short for SHA-160, it would be 160 bits. So it's an alphanumeric string. A's and ones, B's and zeros, C's and ones, D's and zeros, whatever it may be. So letters and numbers. And that's going to represent the integrity check on the data. So hashing equals integrity. That's what you want to make sure you take away from this conversation. In addition, what we then can do is use that integrity check, that hash, that bitstream output, to run forward or backwards and say, has the data been modified at any point in time? We can look at the data a month from now, rehash it. If the bitstream output is still the same, it's always going to be 128 bits if we use MD5, but it's the sequence and ordering of those bits that is really the key to understanding integrity. If we get the identical hash, every alpha and every numeric placeholder is identical from a month ago, then we know the data has not been modified. If we change the data, and all of a sudden, the A's and ones and B's and zeros and the letter C's and threes and fives and nines and whatever are all different, then we know the data has been compromised. It's been modified in some way. We don't know what modification. We just know it has been modified. So there's a limit to what hashing tells us, to be clear. The most important thing it tells us, the only thing of value it tells us, is that data has been modified. Not what was done to modify it, but rather that it has been modified. We want to look at log files and other command and control mechanisms, continuous monitoring, intrusion detection, things of that nature, to figure out the how and the what. We are just now examining and understanding that it actually has been modified with a hash, just to be clear. Digital signatures. Oh, that's a long one. Digital signatures, right? Provides authentication of a sender and integrity of a sender's message. A message, as you could say, is input into a hash function. Well, we just talked about hash functions, so that's interesting. So what we're saying is that effectively a digital signature involves hashing. That's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Then the hash value is encrypted using the private key of the sender. Well, that sounds like it may be important. Somebody's key, identifying a specific person and a specific key. He said suspiciously. I wonder if that's important. And that is, and we're going to talk about why in just a minute. The results of these two steps yield a digital signature. I think we got two bullet points there instead of a period. No, go back up. I think we got two bullet points there instead of a period at the end of signature. Not a big deal. So let's talk about digital signatures, right? Let's break this down, because there's actually three really critical pieces of information inside of this paragraph. So we provide authentication of a sender and integrity of a message. So digital signatures are doing two things. They are providing integrity, validating that the message has not been modified in transit, and they are providing both proof of origin and non-repudiation. They are telling us that somebody definitely sent this message, and we can, in theory, ascribe that understanding of that identity to the individual, meaning we can say, in theory, if Mike digitally signed a message, then I can say that Mike was the one who sent it. But can I really? This is the interesting thing about digital signatures, right? Well, we can say, beyond any reasonable doubt, and we have to talk about doubt and how reasonable doubt is when we talk about this stuff. Beyond any reasonable doubt, we can say that Mike's user identity and Mike's private key was used to send the message. But we don't know if Mike was the person who actually sat down at the keyboard and typed out the message and hit send. As a matter of fact, we're not sure unless we add some sort of additional control, a dual-factor authentication system, for instance, or multi-factor, which would probably involve biometrics to, beyond any reasonable doubt, assure us that Mike was legitimately the person who sat down at the keyboard and actually did engage in this action. We wouldn't know for sure. We take it for granted, and we assume that Mike was the person that did this. But somebody could have, in theory, spoofed Mike's identity and carried out this activity on behalf of Mike, and we would not be able to tell the difference because the credential and the key are legitimately Mike's, and they belong to Mike, and Mike's identity was legitimately used. But the problem is we don't really know for sure whose hand was on the keyboard. So we need to understand, again, the limitation of what a signature or a hash can do for us and the things that we should be aware of that it may not be able to provide. It doesn't provide 100% lock or guarantee that the person that sent the message is the person whose credential was used. We just make that leap of faith and we assume that it is one and the same. But without additional mechanisms, we may not be able to tell beyond any reasonable doubt. But what it does do is it focuses us on the second sentence, the idea that because we are hashing the message and we're using the private key of the sender to be able to do that through a hash and a signature, we are effectively creating an integrity check. The message has not been compromised, not been modified in transit. The message that was sent, in other words, is the message that you receive. In addition, we can validate the identity, again, within reasonable limits, of the sender. And so if I go back to Mike and I say, hey, Mike, I checked this message with the digital signature. I downloaded your public key and did a quick hash comparison, and I validated that it was you that sent me this. Thanks for sending it to me. And Mike says, what are you talking about? I didn't send that message. I'm going to say, well, that's interesting, because according to your digital signature, you did, right? So it provides non-repudiation. Mike really can't deny that his credential was used to send the message. What Mike really should tell me is, hey, I'm not aware of the fact that I sent that message. Somebody may have used my credential without my knowledge because my username and my private key were used, even though I was not the one who actually wrote and sent the message, right? So Mike has to pay attention to what he tells me. I have to pay attention to what he's saying, and we both have to make sure we're saying the right thing. Mike also has to make sure he locks his machine when he walks away from it and doesn't leave Outlook open. So Mike has to practice better physical security. But the idea behind digital signatures is just that. It allows us to understand, in theory, with the integrity check, that the message was not compromised and that the sender whose identity was used, the user account and the private key, cannot claim they didn't engage in that activity because we have what's called non-repudiation and proof of origin. We know they did because their identity was used correctly. This is what digital signatures provide. They do this with a private key. Very important to understand that. We're about to talk about private and private public key pairs. So symmetric encryption is where we use a single key. We call it the private key. Sometimes symmetric encryption is referred to as single key or private key encryption. It's all the same. It simply means we only have one key, and that key is given to the user, whoever that user is. It's issued to them, simply stored in the LDAP directory along with their user information as part of their user profile. So it's mapped, in other words, is what we often say, the key is mapped to the user account in the directory. In Windows, that would be the Active Directory directory service, what we commonly call the Active Directory. In a Linux solution, we may use OpenLDAP. We may just be using a non-Microsoft-based LDAP provider. It doesn't matter. We map the symmetric key to the user's account or the user profile. The private key is meant to be kept secure and not shared with anybody. Now, if you're paying attention to what I just said, then you may start to have the bubbles turning up a little bit in your brain, and they're going to start firing off going, well, wait a second, let's back up, because didn't Adam just talk about digital signatures, and didn't he talk about using the private key of the sender to be able to digitally sign? And if we do that, aren't we exposing the private key? And the answer is no, we're not. And let's talk about why, even though on the surface it may sound like it is, right? The reason we're not doing that is that we talked about the fact that we are not encrypting the message to provide confidentiality with a digital signature. We are signing. We are providing integrity. We are hashing the message. And if you remember, when we hash the message, we're not worried about you seeing the data because we're not worried about keeping it secret. We're not worried about, in other words, providing confidentiality. So the key can be used to create the hash because a hash function, can we go back up to the hash function description just up above? No, earlier up right there. So a hash function, if you remember, is a one-way mathematical operation. In other words, it is theoretically possible to reverse engineer a hash. We never want to say it's impossible to do something because we know in theory there may always be a way to do it. But we consider it to be so unlikely that you could reverse engineer the hash and generate the private key that we're not worried about using the private key to generate the hash because we never actually send the private key. We simply send the data combined with the private key through a hashing algorithm as a 128, 160, 256, 512, et cetera, bit stream of characters that represent the data and the key combined. And being able to reverse engineer that is highly unlikely. And so as a result of that, we still keep the private key secure. So symmetric encryption is indeed focused on security and use of a single private key. Asymmetric, two different but mathematically related keys. When we say they're mathematically related, you could think of them as effectively being a key pair. So they are the public-private key that we use, are used to either encrypt or decrypt. We'll go with a quick TV show reference this time instead of a movie reference, changing things up a little bit for you. Right. Remember Justice League of America?
Uh-huh.
Awesome TV show, awesome cartoon. So in the Justice League of America, they had the Wonder Twins, right? If you remember the Wonder Twins, right, they would put their rings together, shape of, right, and form of, you know, why'd you always want to be a bucket of water? What the hell was going on with that, right?
The boy always picked a very strange shape to be.
There was like a whole subtext to that conversation going on. They were brother and sister, you know, always combining in strange ways. Kind of weird. Then they had the whole crazy monkey, Gleek, running around,
right,
doing the crazy stuff. Yeah, it was a really fun time there back in the 80s when all that was going on. So Wonder Twin powers activate, right? The idea of public-private keys. You have to join them together in order to be able to do something. Just using one key by itself may give us certain abilities, but using both keys together is going to become more powerful. We're going to take a look at how and why that works a little bit later on in one of our other conversations. Moving on. Digital certificates. These are used to identify the certificate holder when conducting electronic transactions. Let's draw that out a little bit. What that really means is a digital certificate is a digital form of identity that represents whoever is the holder, whoever the certificate's been issued to, in terms of providing trust and in terms of providing identity and also potentially things like digital signature capabilities and the ability to validate, for instance, DLLs, lines of code, things of that nature. If we digitally sign, we may be using a certificate to authenticate a website or authenticate a web server. We may be using it to be able to digitally sign emails, things of that nature. Digital certificates have multiple functions. They effectively are going to be little miniature electronic documents that proxy trust and present identity on our behalf. And we'll talk more about how they work and why they work the way they do in one of our upcoming conversations as well. The certificate authority, what's known as the CA, the certificate authority is going to be able to issue these digital certificates we were just talking about. It actually manages the entire life cycle of certificates. It will issue them, as it says in the definition, revoke them, and manage the overall usage and authentication of digital certificates across the entire namespace or across the entire infrastructure that certificates are going to be used through. We have different kinds of certificate authorities. We have what are known as root CAs, and we have what are known as subordinate CAs. They form a hierarchy. Think of a parent-child relationship. A root CA sits at the top of the hierarchy, issuing certificates, but not to users typically, usually to other certificate authorities, what we call the subordinate CAs. And the subordinate CAs get their certificates from a root, and then the root doesn't really talk to users or machines directly, but says to the subordinates, hey, you go ahead and talk to them, and you issue certificates on my behalf with my blessing, with my authority, and then you give those certificates out. So we create what's called a chain of trust from the root through the subordinate to the end user, whoever that may be. If you go into your web browser, regardless of what browser you use, it could be Internet Explorer, could be Firefox, could be Chrome, could be Safari, doesn't matter what. If you go into the appropriate area there and you look for the certificates that are stored in the web server, in the web browser, in the certificate store on the local machine, you will find one or more certificates that have been issued there. And if you look at the intermediate root CA certificates, you will see that they have a trust chain that goes back up to the root certificate authority or the one that sits at the very top. This is how certificate authorities work. Registration authorities are going to be part of a PKI, a public key infrastructure solution that involves certificate authorities. They are special kinds of systems. They may be used, they may not be. They are optional. You don't have to have a registration authority to do PKI, but you do need to have a certificate authority, one or more of them, to do and to issue PKI-based certificates. But a registration authority effectively steps in, as it says there, and deals with making sure the information being provided to the CA is accurate, and it validates identity against the directory store in order to then effectively proxy on behalf of the certificate authority to handle all the heavy lifting to then issue certificates and to allow certificates to be issued. So this is what a registration authority does. Remember, they may be optional. You may or may not need them. We've talked about plain text and ciphertext already. Plain text or clear text sometimes. A little fast on the gun there, Vanna. Plain text or clear text is going to be the text that is going to go into the crypto system and be encrypted or be enciphered in some way. Ciphertext, sometimes referred to as a cryptogram, is now going to be the text that comes out the back end of the system. That is what is enciphered. That is the stuff that we can't read because it's been encrypted. Crypto system. This represents the entire cryptographic operation, including algorithm, key, and key management functions. So the whole enchilada, as they say, in South Florida, is the crypto system. We really do say that in South Florida, by the way. We do. All right. So the crypto system is the entire capability of everything all together. We got to inject a little humor here and there. It's a long day when all you're doing is standing here in your socks and talking. All right. So encryption and decryption. We've also talked about these functions already. Encryption is to actually take plain text and run it through a crypto system and ultimately encipher it, creating ciphertext. Decryption is the process of running it backwards in effect. We take ciphertext, run it through the crypto system, spit it back out the other side as plain text. So we've talked about encryption and decryption as well. The key or the crypto variable is going to be the input, as we talked about, the secret ingredient that is going to be used to be able to drive the operation of the cryptographic algorithm. Remember, it could be a private key, or it could be a private public key pair that we are talking about. I've talked about non-repudiation as well. Non-repudiation is given to us through using integrity controls. This allows us to understand that when we see non-repudiation or think about it, that the person that engaged in that action cannot deny having done so. We talked about the fact that Mike may not have been the person with his hands on the keyboard, but we know Mike's credential was used. So now we have to talk to Mike about whether or not he was really there, because from our perspective, non-repudiation implies that, you know, basically we think he was, right? So we got to be aware of that and think about that. An algorithm is simply going to be the mathematical construct that we use to drive encryption or decryption. Hashing, for instance, also uses algorithms. I mentioned a couple. I said MD5, for instance, and SHA-1. These are encryption algorithms, but specifically, or excuse me, these are hashing algorithms that are specifically designed to do hashing. We have encryption algorithms such as AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard Algorithm. We have DES, or Triple DES, the Data Encryption Standard Algorithm. We have IDEA. We have Twofish, Blowfish, Redfish, Bluefish, for those of you that are Dr. Seuss fans. We have all sorts of algorithms that are dealing with cryptography and specifically encryption. And we'll talk more about some of those in some of our upcoming conversations. Continuing on, we have cryptanalysis, the study of techniques for attempting to defeat cryptographic systems. Cryptanalysis is the study of and the art and science of trying to break cryptographic systems. So to figure out how to steal keys, use them to decrypt systems, how to break them using a variety of different attacks, that's cryptanalysis. Cryptology, down at the bottom there, is the science that deals with hidden, disguised, or encrypted communications. One of my students once told me cryptology was the art and science of studying crypts. Not really what we're talking about here. But that's the Egyptian hieroglyphic class down the hallway. So collision, this occurs when a hash function generates the same output for different inputs. We don't want to have patterns, as we have often talked about, right? Anything that is same, anything that is going to repeat, is not good when we talk about encryption. Collisions are bad because collisions imply that something that is different, two different things, have generated the same end result. And that is a problem, right? That is the problem. Because if we can see a pattern, if we can get two different keys to generate the same end result, we now can figure out how to break that system because now we have two pieces of very valuable information. The key space. Key space represents a total number of possible values of all keys in the cryptographic system. In other words, the key space is the entire mathematical construct, the value, the all-up number of all the keys that are possibly available to us inside that crypto system. We often represent this as a power of 2 to the 512th or something like that, 2 with 512 zeros after it. That's a very large check for us to write, or a very big check to write that. 2 to 512 power is going to be 2 with 512 zeros after it. A key space may have that many keys in it depending on the bit strength of the algorithm being used. If it's a 4,096-bit algorithm, we are talking about an incredibly large key space. If it's a 56-bit algorithm, we're talking about a very small key space. So the key space is simply the overall all-up number of keys. Work factor, the time and effort required to break a protective measure. Work factor is a measure in time of how long you will have to work to break the crypto system. That's usually a very long time, depending on how strong the crypto system is. Initialization vector, what's commonly called an IV. An IV is effectively a random value. It's non-secret. We don't necessarily hide it from you. It's a non-secret value. A binary vector is just fancy, you know, cipher talk for mathematical information. It's just bits that we stick into the first run of the algorithm, taking the first crack at the plain text as we inserted it into the system. So effectively, we're padding some additional information into that. By doing that, what we're doing is inserting some randomness into the encryption run. And because of that, what then happens is that additional initialization vector has to be added to the mix when we reverse engineer in order to be able to get the right information back and get the plain text back going out the back end. Because we add the initialization vector with the data and the key in the algorithm. And now in order to unwind all that, you need to know all of that in order to do it the right way. Now, initialization vectors by themselves are not necessarily very strong, but we map them to something known as an XOR function. XORing implies that we are going to take the output of one run and then use it as the input for the next to re-encrypt. And as we re-encrypt multiple times, we're pushing that randomness further into the mix by effectively wrapping it in multiple layers of additional cryptography or additional encryption. And we have to unwind every one of those, XORing the opposite way, to unencrypt and do so successfully by knowing the pattern and the sequence. This is why this can become very complicated very quickly. Encoding, continuing down, and decoding. Encoding is the action of effectively taking a message, right, plain text, and as you heard me say, encoding it or enciphering it into ciphertext. Decoding, the exact opposite. We run it the other way. We take ciphertext and we decode it. We run it back through and create plain text on the back end. Transposition or permutation, just a few more, I promise you. We're almost at the end. Transposition or permutation. And notice, by the way, I've not taken a breath the entire time we've been talking.
I've been pretty impressed.
Transportation. Transposition or permutation. Transposition or permutation is the idea of being able to substitute certain things or move them around, but not just substitute the way substitution says, but to transpose them, specifically to move them around in a certain order. So when we transpose, we say that the letter A now becomes the letter Z, and the letter B becomes the letter Y or something like that. And we're transposing, we're shifting, in effect, or permutating. We are modifying in some way. That's what transposition or permutation is about. Substitution is just a very simple thing. The letter A is really the number one. The letter B is really the number two. And so when we write, the dog is blue, we would find the numerical equivalence, and we would simply say 1579, and then we would translate that back to the dog is blue. That would be substitution, right? SP network, the SP network stands for, and by the way, SP stands for substitution and permutation, as we talked about, which is effectively transpositioning. When we talked about the idea of XORing, right, and taking the output of one run and using it as the input for the next, it was kind of hinting at this. It says most block ciphers do a series of repeated substitutions and permutations to add what's called confusion and diffusion, defined below, to the encryption process. So the SP network is this idea of using substitution and permutation, ultimately, to add confusion and diffusion to the system so that we further obfuscate, further hide the original data, and make it that much more difficult for somebody to break the encryption. Confusion provides or allows us to effectively provide the idea of changing and mixing up things to effectively add so much randomness seemingly into the system that it's very hard for us to really understand what is the real data and what is the data that's been modified through multiple XORs, multiple permutations along the way, effectively rendering not the real data, but a representation of the encrypted data multiple times over. Diffusion is the idea of mixing up the location so that way, as we scatter the plain text throughout what becomes the ciphertext, people don't know where the real data is and where the buffering and padding is. And as a result, they're not sure what to decrypt and what is real and what is not. Very crafty on our part, by the way. Avalanche effect, right? The avalanche effect, that should be the last one. The avalanche effect is going to be where a minor change in either the key or the text itself, the plain text, has a significant resulting change in ciphertext. What we often talk about with this is really what's known as more generally the butterfly effect. You may have heard of the butterfly effect, right? A butterfly flapping its wings in the Amazon leads to global climate change because of a series of small but interlocking and related events that become larger and more amplified as they go. The classic example of this is dropping a pebble or a rock into a pool of water. You see the rippling waves and move outwards from the point of contact, and they become broader and wider as they go, touching more of the body of water. This is what the avalanche effect is. When we XOR through the data runs, if we have a small error in the beginning and we wrap that error up and then we use the output of that run to become the input for the next and we amplify the error going forward 20 times, a little error right here becomes a massive error on the back end because it gets amplified through all those runs. That's what the avalanche effect is. I'm going to stop talking right now because if I don't take a breath, I'm going to pass out.
Very good, Adam. We sure do appreciate all those definitions, and hopefully we're not going to have to use each one of those in a sentence at the end of the day. We have to bring that in tomorrow.
There's a quiz.
There's going to be a quiz.
There's a quiz.
So you're going to have to spell all of those and use them in a proper sentence. Now, great information there. You know, vocabulary, obviously very important to understanding everything we've talked about and things that we're going to talk about and for becoming a CAISSP. So we've got to know those terms. Thank you for spelling those out for us. I'll make sure that those definitions are up on the site so you guys can download them, make your electronic flashcards like Adam talked about, study those, know those well. That is going to do it for this particular episode. We are out of time. We're going to have more coming up. We'll have a part four for this episode, so make sure you come back for that. And if you guys want to attend one of Adam's classes, make sure you shoot us an email, cadam@itpro.tv. But for now, signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm IT Pro TV.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.